I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Dr. Tony Watlington spent 27 years in education in North Carolina. He began as a bus driver and custodian, and in 1994 was hired as a history teacher. A few years later, he was named Teacher of the Year. He's worked as a principal, chief of schools, and until recently was the superintendent of Rowan-Salisbury School District with a student body of 18,000. In June, he began a new job here in Philadelphia as superintendent of the School District of Philadelphia, overseeing the education of some 114,000 students. He has spent the summer on a listening and learning tour, talking with teachers and principals, students, district staffers, parents, and community members. He's had the input of some 80 leaders in Philadelphia to help him set priorities and better understand how the district works or should work, and the advice of an out-of-town consulting firm. It's been a tough few years for educators, students, and their parents because of the COVID pandemic, Philadelphia's rampant gun violence crisis, and longstanding high rate of poverty dramatically impacts education, which makes a strong school year more important than ever. School begins on Monday. Well, today on Radio Times, meet Dr. Tony Watlington, the Philadelphia's new school superintendent. He joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. My pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And let me just make sure our listeners could join us. We want to hear from parents and teachers and students and interested parties. You can email us at radiotimes at whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. As I mentioned, you have been on this listening, learning tour. What has been your major takeaway as you talk with stakeholders here in Philadelphia?
Absolutely. I've talked with a number of stakeholders, to include teachers, parents, students, grassroots organizations, lots of elected officials, and supporters of the school district. And what I've learned in these first 60 days is that we have a very passionate city.
Not surprising there.
With people who are not gun shy about telling you what they really think.
That's a good thing, though, isn't it?
It is. I appreciate the candor and the spirit of the city. I've learned that all of these groups at the end of the day want us to figure out how to make sure that schools are safe, number one. They want us to figure out how to work together. They believe the city can do better. Our schools can do better. They want us to develop strategies and be accountable for accelerating academic achievement for all students, to include many of our underperforming groups. And they want us to figure out how to communicate better with them and to improve customer service along the way, all of which we are looking forward to doing just that.
Well, I want to talk about all of that because that is so central to your job. But I just want to remark on the fact that, you know, schools, it opens Monday, children will be back in the classroom. What do you think has been the impact of COVID on the education of young people?
I think the impact of COVID on our young people has been significant, not limited to, number one, significant learning loss. I think we're going to find that when the PSSA data and other data are verified later this fall, that there was significant learning loss, and it shows up in state assessments. Not that that's the only way that we right. ought to assess student performance. On a qualitative note, I've had scores of young people tell me across the city this summer that they not only feel somewhat disconnected to their peers and their teachers, some of our students tell me that they've become more insular, they've pulled back, they don't interact quite the same way. Many of our students told me that, and we knew this from studies that have been done, and it was also included in the Children First report earlier this summer, that they've experienced an uptick in anxiety, uptick in depression. Many of them told me they have friends or relatives who called some of the suicide hotlines during the pandemic, and that continues to be an issue. So we know, based on that feedback, that we've got to be focused on how we significantly accelerate academic achievement in the district, and we've got to be equally focused, and I underscore equally, focused on attending to our students' social and emotional health, as well as their physical safety.
I mean, that requires teachers, also counselors, having the skills, the wherewithal, the time to be able to create this environment where children feel safe, where they feel understood, where they feel accepted, where they can share some of these feelings. I know you're something at 97.4% of the teachers and counselors
yes,
that need to be hired, but that leaves, I think, about 200 vacancies at this point. Are you prepared to manage all that?
Yes. We are. Will be utilizing other paraprofessionals, who some who are very highly trained substitutes, others who do other jobs in the district and in the schools, who will take on the job of meeting those kids in those classrooms when they show up on Monday. To your point about the needs of children, we've invested quite heavily through our student services department in training for not just teachers and counselors, because our children tell me that the counselor ratios are way too high.
Yeah.
And some of our
counselors would say that as well.
And they would say that as well. And so we know that on the one hand, we'd love to have more counselors, behavioral support specialists, mental health professionals for students who need it. So one of the ways we're trying to attack that need is through very intentional professional development, which is not surprising. We're a people centered organization where close to 80% of our budget is spent on people and benefits. We're a people intensive organization. And so some of that training relates to trauma informed care, de-escalation, conflict resolution, and the like. And we have to do that every year, given that we lose some teachers and staff. And so we have to constantly make that investment.
Well, and added to that, and I mentioned this in my introduction, Philadelphia, like other cities, is dealing with this crisis of gun violence. And oftentimes, young people, especially young men, are, and some of them school-age students, are really at risk for either being the victim or somehow being an observer, a witness of violence that is really traumatizing for so many young people. How does the district deal with that?
Well, over the summer, our chief of safety in the school district, Chief Kevin Bethel and myself, have been meeting throughout the summer with Commissioner Outlaw and members of her staff to share information, to coordinate, to plan very, very intentionally, beginning well before the first day of school, to make sure that we keep our kids safe. I do want to underscore that schools are some of the safest places in the city of Philadelphia, and the data would support that. We've been working with Commissioner Outlaw to continue our safe passage initiatives with law enforcement, community volunteers, and we're working in some areas to pay community members to be a part of that safe passage to and from schools. But I want to underscore that schools are some of the safest placed in the city of Philadelphia and certainly in the Commonwealth. In addition to those safe corridors, we've also had a chance to meet with all of our school safety officers who work in our schools under Chief Bethel's leadership. I was really impressed and inspired by the extent to which they really do want to build positive relationships with our students, and we're going to redouble our efforts in that regard across the district. That's so important because in addition to having police presence around schools and throughout the city, we know, based on what we've seen nationally, that what really matters, in addition to all the other preventive measures for violence, is that we have to build relationships. Relationships are key. Relationships between students, relationships between students and staff, relationships between staff and families. And that's why I'm so focused in this listening and learning tour of promoting this sense about collaboration. We also know that when students and families are connected and feel connected, people are more likely to see something and say something versus the reverse.
We've done a number of shows about the problem of gun violence in Philadelphia, and one of the explanations is that because schools were closed and students were not in classrooms and not talking to teachers and not talking to counselors, that may be one of the reasons why we've seen the spike in violence. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense. And a lot of other urban districts, and quite frankly, some of the non-urban large urban districts are having the same thinking. You know, there's just something about schools being this place where our children and young people have consistent routines, consistent structures. And there's just something about the power of teachers that build relationships and guidance counselors and other paraprofessionals. So the relationships became very, very disjointed and in many cases dysfunctional for a lot of children, not to mention that, you know, systems where kids could eat and those kind of things at school really had a tremendous impact on them. I don't think we fully understand the full impact of the pandemic on our young people just yet.
And we'll find out probably more this year as we spend more time with students. Now, the first 10 days here in Philadelphia, students, staff, they are going to be required to wear masks. After 10 days, I guess there will be some kind of evaluation. That's unusual. I think most districts are allowing staff and students back maskless. Why masking in Philadelphia?
I think that it's important for our community to know first, I strongly believe that the strategies to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 and other illnesses is the responsibility of not just school staffs, but the entire city. And so that's really important to note on the outset. Secondly, last year we hired a nationally respected epidemiologist and pediatrician, Dr. Kendra McDowell. She and our chief of student services have been meeting consistently with PDHP and CHOP over the summer. And while I won't opine on what's appropriate in other cities and locales, I will say that we've tried our very best to follow the science and to be collaborative partners with our public health department and local authorities, and we think this is the right decision informed by the science and the research.
I'm looking, we're almost about a minute from our first break here. Do you, though, have to prepare, looking at the last 2 years, that yes, schools will open, children will be in classrooms, but maybe, you know, once we're into the dead of winter, we could go remote again? Do you have to plan for that kind of contingency?
Yes, we have multiple contingency plans, and they are not written in stone. We continue to review conditions across the city and to work with those partners I referenced earlier so that we can be nimble and so that we can make decisions that are focused narrowly on how do we keep our students in school safely such that they can continue with in-person learning.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking with Philadelphia's new school superintendent, Dr. Tony Watlington. He began his job back in June, just a couple of months ago, and he spent the last couple of months on a listening and learning tour, maybe a learning and listening tour. I forget which word comes first. But anyway, he spent some time in the city listening first. Okay, and then learning. I hear you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Especially if you're a teacher here in Philadelphia, or a parent, or a student, or a stakeholder. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The School District of Philadelphia starts the new academic year on Monday with a new superintendent, our guest Tony Watlington. Today on Radio Times, a conversation with Dr. Watlington about what he learned on his listening tour. We'll be talking about his educational philosophy and how he plans to tackle the many challenges facing the district. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. It's that Casey says, time to move on already. No more masks in school. Dr. Watlington?
You know, even though we've made the decision to mask for the first 10 days of the school year, I am very sensitive to and quite frankly understand people who see the world a bit differently. I don't always like to wear my mask either. I think that I tell myself all the time it's important to follow the science, be connected with local conditions here in Philadelphia, and sometimes it's important to operate out of an abundance of caution That's informed by the science, not just gut reaction or thinking. And I'm really sensitive to small children, particularly our early grades in kindergarten through the second and third grade, where it's really important for children to be able to see their teacher's affect, watch them pronounce syllables and words as we focus on phonemic awareness, and particularly, right. in particular, as our strategy for improving literacy. So I understand it, and we're hopeful that as a city we'll mitigate the spread of, take those safety measures to inside and outside of school as appropriate, to include vaccinations and the like, so that after 10 days we can unmask, and I hope we could stay unmasked for the entire duration of the school year.
Well,
that's my hope and aspiration.
Fingers crossed here. We know a lot about a teacher shortage, and as I mentioned, you're, I think, 97.4% close to full employment here in Philadelphia. There's something like 700 new teachers. I don't know if they're actually new to education or new to Philadelphia, but nonetheless, you've got 700 new teachers. What do they need to be successful?
Teachers need to know, one, that we're going to wrap our arms around them and take care of them. And what that means is we have to be very thoughtful about how we recruit teachers, how we onboard teachers. And I got a chance to speak with 700 teachers and other educators a couple of weeks ago. And I said to them that we want to be very intentional about how we onboard you into schools. Not here. Here are the keys to your classroom. Go do it. Have a good year. We'll check in with you around the holiday time. Now, we've got to be strategic about how we onboard, support, and develop teachers. This is so, it seems simple. It's so important because the research over 50 years in this nation tells us that the single most important factor in student academic growth and attainment is a well-qualified, well-supported, highly qualified, well-supported, and stable teaching force over time. And so the other way we do that after we onboard, support, and retain great teachers is we have to facilitate their professional development. We have in areas like making sure that they fully understand the content standards that they're charged with teaching. And also, we have to make sure that we're providing adequate support for teachers in terms of pedagogy. That's a fancy word that simply means, how do we engage students? The days of sitting in straight rows, and we sit up straight, like when I went to school.
And I hated that, I have to say, when I went sitting still in a desk and chair.
Sure. We know it is a relic of the past for a lot of children. Is there value in paying attention and sitting up straight? Absolutely. The old British model, I like to call it. But our kids have so much that they experience inside and outside of school. We live in an age of fast food, 24-hour grocery stores in some places, cell phones are everywhere, and we're not going to be able to just lock all those up, put them away in a locker, and somehow walk into glory days gone by. So we have to figure out how to really actively engage students in the learning. Less lecture, more teacher as facilitator. Kids have to do rigorous writing, thinking. We have to help teachers to create classrooms environments where teachers aren't working themselves so hard that they go home super tired. And sometimes kids go home and they're not tired. And part of that means is we have to give kids some ownership in the learning. A great classroom is a classroom where kids are talking, they're facilitating, they are defending their point of view based on evidence from the text. They're good writing and rewriting. And so we've got to flip the classroom model a bit. But that takes a great deal of professional development and support for teachers, because it's quite frankly very different than what we did 40 or 50 years, or quite frankly when I went to school.
Well, me as well. And it requires, I think, a certain kind of person to be able to be that certain kind of teacher. It also requires a principal who is going to provide the kind of support that you describe and make sure that a teacher is teaching, but as you say, teaching without exhausting themselves.
I love that you said that, because the research says teachers are the most influential factor in student learning, irrespective of race, ethnicity, how much money you have or don't have, what your family structure looks like. The research is incontrovertible on that point. The research also tells us that the second most impactful area in terms of student academic attainment is the principal. And the principal's number two, but so important because they're the people who recruit, onboard, develop, support, and retain those star teachers.
How important is it to have more teachers of color, either teachers who are African-American or perhaps Latino or Latina? I think we did a show recently with some teachers, and I ran across a statistic in Philadelphia that I think something like 25% of the teacher workforce is African-American, is Black. Does that need to be increased, improved?
Absolutely. The research literature in this country tells us in the K-12 space that kids of color, particularly African-American and Latinx kids, do better academically. They have higher confidence levels and they perform better when they have access to teachers who look like them and that they can relate to in a cultural context. So I think that what we're going to focus on here in the district as a part of our work going forward is to bring forward some specific strategies that will help us to, A, expand our recruitment of teachers, expand our footprint beyond the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. We already do some of that, but we're going to redouble our efforts so that we're very intentional about how we recruit teachers in the nation's more than 100-plus historically Black colleges and universities. Many of those are actually in the South. North Carolina has the highest number of four-year historically Black colleges or university in the country.
Where you come from.
Where I come from. And so I know where there's a pipeline of a few of those teachers we can go after. And I believe Alabama has the highest number of two-year historically Black colleges. In addition, there are minority-serving institutions like Georgia State University and others that are not traditional HBCUs, but there's a teaching pipeline we can go after. And then we can expand our footprint in the predominantly white institutions as well. That's one strategy. I would also say very quickly that we also want to figure out how we grow our own. And so certainly the School District of Philadelphia already has an initiative afoot in the talent office where we are working to help paraprofessionals get their teaching credentials. I believe we're doing that at no cost. And we want to work with groups like Sharif Al-Mekki, who I studied long before Bill Dr. Height retired.
Show. Yeah.
And he has a national presence. Lots of districts across the country want to work with that organization. Since it's here in Philadelphia, we're going to figure out how to scale up some of our partnership work.
What do you tell white teachers then? White teachers who are teaching in Philadelphia.
I think it takes all of us. The fact that we need to recruit significantly higher numbers of African-American and Latinx teachers certainly does not mean that we don't value the white teachers that we have. The good problem that we have is we have so many vacancies that we don't have to displace anybody. We can do this through attrition, and it's the right thing to do.
I read that you favor teachers getting dual certification, and one of those certifications, including special education teaching. Did I read that right?
Yes, I absolutely favor teachers getting dual certifications. I think it has implications for how we support teachers, how we compensate teachers, and quite frankly, how we train teachers in colleges and universities across the Commonwealth and across the country. Now, the fact that the numbers of people in the country who are going into teacher education programs, public or private, is down by about 50% over the past 5 years.
Yeah.
And the last study I read said it's down by about 67% here in the Commonwealth, tells me that we're going to have non-traditional teachers, Teach for America, lots of other groups, teachers prepared by Sharif Al-Mekki and other groups, and we're going to have to figure out ways to develop and support them and pay for them to get those credentials.
I also read that it's often common after 5 years for a teacher to leave the profession, that seems to be the kind of burnout time.
Absolutely. And so we have to be intentional about how we onboard them in year one.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We got some comments and questions coming in. Our guest is Dr. Tony Watlington. He is Philadelphia's new school superintendent. He got the job this past spring and began working here in the city in June. And again, you can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a listener comment here. It says, I'm newly arrived in Philadelphia, young black male professional with a law degree and always had an interest in teaching. I did receive an offer of $48,000 from the school district, which I obviously could not accept or live on. If wages are so low, how can you attract and sustain a qualifying workforce? And, you know, as we know, most teachers are underpaid.
Absolutely. I agree. And I'll tell you one of the things you'll never hear Tony Watlington say. You'll never hear me say, well, teachers don't go into this job to get rich. I believe that how we expend our budgets says something about what we value. I think that it's interesting. We live in a market economy, and typically a market capitalistic economies, supply and demand factors have a way of contributing to salary structures. So I think it's really important that we take a hard look at what we value and what we believe in the Commonwealth and across the nation in terms of this steadily declining force of people who are choosing to go in to teacher education programs. And this gentleman who's a lawyer who could bring some value to our school district, but who won't come to us because of depressed salaries. And I think this is one of the biggest threat. I think the declining pipeline of teachers is our greatest threat to democracy and national security. I really believe that.
Have you been to Harrisburg to make an argument for more money for district schools?
Absolutely. I visited Harrisburg. I look forward to continuing to build relationships with our legislators. Really appreciate Governor Wolf's leadership here in the Commonwealth in that regard.
And there is an ongoing lawsuit as well having to do with funding for schools.
Absolutely. I was so pleased to find to hear from Senator Vincent Hughes about an event about some additional dollars that will come to the School District of Philadelphia this year as a result of the support that the legislators agreed to. We need more of that. Lots more of that.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about you. You come, as I mentioned, you were a bus driver, you were a custodian. It seems like you've had just about a teacher as well and a superintendent and a principal. You've had almost every job one can possibly have within a school. You also come from a school district of just 18,000. And here in Philadelphia, it's 114 or 115,000 students. How did working in a smaller district prepare you for working in a bigger one?
Well, I'd say first, you know, when you have the experience working in a smaller district where people have to do lots of jobs, you get very good of really understanding the work functions of a school district. And it makes me really acutely sensitive to controlling for the potential siloing of different areas or departments of the organization. It's made me very community and externally focused because I know that school districts, teachers, and principals can't do this work alone. So we have to develop systems and structures to actually engage with our community. I think it also helps me to understand the power of having all key voices around the table. Every time I think about an important policy, practice, or decision, first question I ask myself, are key people around the table? Do we have the representatives? Two, how might that decision impact each group? And three, this is really, really important, and we miss this a lot of the time. How might the decision be perceived by each group? So I'm always thinking about things from not just the perspective of teachers and principals who are first in the research in terms of impact on student learning, but how are bus drivers, custodians, social workers, school psychologists, guidance counselors, and others impact it? And how do we make sure they have voice somewhere at the table? Because if the buses don't run on time, if the guidance counselors aren't connected, if speech pathologists can't do their best work, then teachers and principals can't do their best work. So the final thing I've learned about being in a smaller district, great teaching in an 18,000 student district is not terribly different than great teaching in a district the size of Philadelphia or great teaching in New York City, which is the largest public school district in the world. Great system structures and approaches to teaching are scalable.
This is a big union town. I know North Carolina was less of a union state than certainly Philadelphia is as a city. The Philadelphia Federation of Teachers is a strong union. They work hard, lobby hard for their teachers. How do you want to have a relationship with them? What would be a productive relationship?
A productive relationship is one where we're talking regularly. Certainly, it's one where we develop trust, notwithstanding the issues that sometimes we may see differently. I think that at the end of the day, we all want the same thing. I really do believe that. I believe in labor. I believe in the labor story in the United States, certainly going back to the National Labor Relations Act and the great AFL-CIO. So I believe I'm a historian. So I understand the importance of advocating for the workers who do the work. I'm a big believer that we ought to pay living wages to all of our employees. And I'm new to a union state. North Carolina is a right to work state, but we still had to spend a good amount of our time and energy negotiating with the North Carolina Association of Educators to figure out how we tackle some of these very tough issues related to compensation, related to teacher quality, related to teacher support, relating to how we get more legislative support for supporting public school districts.
It's a tall order.
Tall order indeed.
And we have to take another short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about, especially when it comes to education and the fact that Philadelphia has a new school superintendent. His name is Dr. Tony Watlington, and as I mentioned, he spent 27 years in education in North Carolina, beginning as a bus driver and custodian. His last job there was superintendent of a school district called Rowan-Salisbury, and he's been here in Philadelphia since June, getting the lay of the land. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I see a lot of comments here. Do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Dr. Tony Watlington, the new school superintendent for the School District of Philadelphia. Let me ask you about some consultants that were hired. Now, there were some 80 consultants hired here in Philadelphia to help you understand the city and how it works and how the district should work or is working. But there was also an outside firm that was hired titled Joseph & Associates, based in Tennessee. Why was an outside firm hired to help you understand Philadelphia?
I'll say a couple of things. First, I think it's really important to get a detailed overview of what's included in the Joseph & Associates contract that I asked the Board of Education to approve prior to my start date. Your listeners can go to my 100 days plan website, www.philasd/100days.org, and it outlines it provides an itemization of that budget. Second,
it's $450,000.
It's a bench contract, not to exceed $450,000. Second. Third thing I want to clarify is that there are two lead consultants with that contract, Dr. Sean Joseph, who's the former MetLife Principal of the Year for the state of Maryland, former superintendent in Delaware, as well as in Nashville, Tennessee, and who currently works, who leads the American Association of School Administrators, Urban Superintendents Academy at Howard University, and Dr. Betty Morgan, who is a former chief academic officer in Baltimore. She's also a former National Superintendent of the Year. They are lead consultants working with a group of people who are supporting and advising me. So part of what they do is not just help me to hit the ground running in terms of my assessment of the eighth largest school district in the country. When you think about traditional schools, public schools, and the charter schools, I think it's really important to note that they're also helping me strategically work on three big phases of work. So it's not just to help me understand, it's to be strategic about how we build on the good work that Dr. Bill Height did here over 10 years and extend that good work. So we've got three phases of work: a listening and learning tour at phase one. The second is a transition team that includes over 80 Philadelphians and some local and national experts who really have their ears to the ground in terms of what's working well in other urban districts. And then later this fall, we're going to begin the development of an aggressive five-year strategic plan. And so it's a bench contract of work that will occur throughout the year. There are a number of consultants, some of whom are from Philadelphia. Mm. I understand that $450,000
it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money to the taxpayer, me being one of those. But I think it's absolutely a legitimate use of the resource, because we have to ask ourselves, what will we do differently to build on that work of the Height administration and to significantly improve literacy in particular?
Well, and that is such a critical question, though. Let me ask you about Sean Joseph. He's the leader of Joseph and Associates, and as you mentioned, was superintendent of Metropolitan Nashville Public School System. He had that less than 3 years, and I'm reading from the Philadelphia Choir, HYY, and some others, chalkboard here in Philadelphia. The board bought out his contract. There were questions about no-bid contracts, school bus drivers as a chauffeur, maintenance employee working at his house, that there were a series of red flags. The vice chair of the Nashville Board of Education, Jill Sperling, was appalled that he was hired. Another board member, Amy Frog, said that his practices precipitated an employee morale crisis. So there were a number of red flags. I don't want to spend the rest of the hour talking
sure.
about this. But, you know, and as the Philadelphia Inquirer's editorial board said, the guy from Tennessee is going to help the guy from North Carolina find his way around Philadelphia. But the question is, why Sean Joseph?
Well, I don't need a hand holder to find my way around Philadelphia. I will say I've been quite successful at significantly improving academic outcomes in an 18,000 student district and in a 73,000 student district, and leading some innovative work. Dr. Joseph, I can tell you that I am aware of some social media commentary, which mm-hmm. I won't opine on at this time, but I will tell you that I've also received very glowing recommendations from the current chair, a board president in Metro Nashville Schools, the former board president in Metro Nashville Schools, who was there when Dr. Joseph was the superintendent, and also from other board members. So, we've chosen to stay focused on the work, and we think the results that we achieve right. will speak for themselves. One of the things that's unique about Sean Joseph, or at least about the Urban Superintendents Academy at Howard mm-hmm. University in Washington, D.C.
Of which you're a graduate,
correct? I'm a graduate of that academy. There are two. One is at Howard University on the East Coast. There's one at the University of Southern California, USC, on the West Coast. Howard University is so unique because they have a group of faculty and researchers that are really digging into studying and researching urban districts that are moving the needle. My aspiration is that we will become the fastest improving, not the fastest growing in terms of population, but the fastest improving urban school district among the large urbans. And that connection with Howard University, I think, is going to be really important to that aspiration.
So time will tell whether this was the right decision or not.
This is the one time I will quote President Reagan up front on this kind of an answer. President Reagan once said, trust but verify.
Okay, fair enough.
So I'll just ask the community to trust but verify.
Okay, and we will find out. Here's Rob asks, what is your view on the role of the school district in advocating for stable housing for the most vulnerable students? And I mentioned in my introduction it said a lot because it's true that this is the poorest large city in the country, the top 10 size cities. And there are obviously impacts when children grow up in poverty, including the fact that some of them are unhoused. I mean, that they're living in shelters or they're going from, you know, one sure. house to another.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I look at that. I'll answer that question in two ways. One, from my own personal experience of being a child who qualified for free and reduced lunch in school. And it didn't necessarily have to limit my life chances. So that's part of my why, quite frankly. I know we can make public education work. I know public education built the middle class in this country. And I am certain that that public education is what helped to develop into the world's largest economy. The second way I'll answer that question is, I was talking with a colleague from Finland one time, mm-hmm. and I never forgot this. He said to me, Tony, we have kids in the early grades who struggle to read no different than what you have in urban areas, rural areas, and suburban areas, particularly urban areas in the United States. What we do differently in Finland, though, is we do a better job of ensuring that all of our young people have an opportunity to participate in the economy, to obtain a living wage and be able to take care of their families in meaningful ways, number one. And number two, we make health care a basic national right. So,
and we don't have that.
I'm a free market. Yet. I'm a free market capitalist, but I still believe there's a space for having strategies that give more of our people an opportunity to participate in the economy and have a living wage, and we can do better with health care. I think we do those two things, and we can partner up with those great teachers and principals, and we can accelerate achievement.
Well, that would be terrific. Here's a comment from Michael, kind of related to what you just said. Their high school is filled with kids who are interested in the trades, like carpentry. And, I mean, there is a lot of focus on higher education, either a community college or a four-year college or even beyond. But what about the trades? And you can make some pretty good money as a carpenter.
Absolutely. In Rowan Salisbury Schools in North Carolina, where I served as superintendent, we were the only renewal school district in the state, which means that the legislature voted to give my school district a waiver from a lot of the state rules. Long story short, we figured out how to position ourselves number four among 115 school districts in the sheer number of students who graduated having participated in a rigorous career and technical education pathway. Such that they were able to command much higher incomes after they graduated. So my kids would do things like traditional trades to include carpentry and masonry, and they made a good income. They were able to take care of their families. I'm a big believer in that. At the same time, as a renewal school district, we were going to keep those skilled trades. We need carpenters. We need masonry workers. We need plumbers. At the same time, there's a growing body of career and technical education jobs related to artificial intelligence, related to advanced manufacturing, and a number of other jobs that we have to retool and reskill individuals to be shovel ready for those jobs. It's one of the reasons why I asked Dr. Guy Generals, president at the Community College of Philadelphia, to be co-chair of my transition team, because we want to really exponentially grow those programs that already exist in the district.
Here's an email from Gilly. How will you encourage teachers and staff to teach and model constructive conflict resolution to all of our students?
Constant professional development, ongoing professional development. Every time teachers leave the profession or leave within the first 5 years, all those dollars that we invested in the teachers go to one of the neighboring school districts, and they never send us a check to say thank you.
Yeah.
So we want to retain great teachers after we do that good training.
Well, here's Sarah who says, I'm a former teacher that got burned out. How do you plan to address the major issue of equal access to resources by neighborhoods? Zip codes dictate the state of your classroom books. And certainly had teachers on this program talking about the fact that they often have to pay out of pocket for basic supplies. They may not have air conditioning, you know, the heat may be, or they may have asbestos problems. We've got a lot of old school buildings in this city. How do you address things like burnout?
First, I think we have to acknowledge that burnout is very real. Yeah. Burnout is real for teachers, and it's real for principals. We have to invest in teachers to make sure that they have professional learning. We're taking the time to really listen to teachers now, and we're asking very intentional questions like, do you have the resources that you need day one in your schools, curricular resources, support resources, supplies and materials and the like? And what can we do to ensure that we support you in this area of self-care? I'm not so sure that 10 years ago, I remember anybody asking teachers, they certainly didn't ask me, what are you doing for your self-care and how do I help you to do support that? I'm a CrossFit exerciser. I like to run. I eat relatively healthy, except when I binge in some of these very fine restaurants here in Philadelphia. But it made us think about not just student well-being, but also staff well-being. Burnout is a real phenomenon. We realize that.
And is there money for that? I mean, it always comes back to money, doesn't it?
It's not enough. We have resources in our talent office and employee assistance program. I'm not sure to the extent to which teachers who are at risk for burning out or experiencing burnout symptoms or principals make use of it, but it is something that we're paying close attention to.
Here's an email from Stu. How will you respond to the pressure to ban books? And is there pressure in Philadelphia from parents and others to ban books? Is that an issue here in the city? There's a district up in Bucks County where it is a profound issue that's gotten national attention. How about here in the city?
Banning book issues. Books is an issue that I did experience in a couple of districts in North Carolina. I will tell you that it's not been an issue that I've heard of here in Philadelphia, but I think that our kids are very resilient, and we enrich the curriculum when we expose our students to a wide array of viewpoints and philosophies. And so I certainly am not a book ban a proponent.
I hear you. How about parents? I mean, how important is parental either buy-in, relationship, contact to the success of a student performing in school?
I think parent engagement is essential. Now, it looks different for different parents. I don't tend to think about parental engagement in terms of just serving on a school leadership committee or volunteering or even, fundraising, where they're selling brownies, wrapping paper and the like. I really think parent engagement, and I know lots of parents who never show up in a school building, some of whom don't show up in a school building because they just entrust their kids to us educators, that old in loco parentis doctrine, where they just know they trust us to take care of the children. I think for me, parental engagement is initially about sending children to school every day, one, sending children to school on time, two, and three, at a minimum, ensuring that kids arrive in school with a reasonably good attitude. Doesn't have to be perfect, but a reasonably good attitude. And I think that because of my historical study of a time period in the United States when there were lots of people who could not read, they sent their children to school every day or as often as they could, had very little money. Kids learned how to read even though their parents couldn't help them learn how to read at home. And so that just informs my thinking about how we, identify the strengths in our parents in various communities. And I think it's essential. Parents are their children's first teachers.
Well, we got to leave it there. Dr. Wadlington, thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us at AM Radio Times.
My pleasure to be here with you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And he is the brand new superintendent for the School District of Philadelphia. To find out more about WHYY or Radio Times, go to WHYY.org, look for Radio Times under programs, and you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.